wisely. In the struggle, don't forget your children and your wifey. If you don't see me on the podium preaching it, every day I hope my every action is teaching it. Cause revolution is a process, it's not a speech or a panel. Don't bite off more than you can handle.
Turn the music back on.
In a minute. First, noble human Homer Simpson will explain his primitive yet beautiful culture.
But perhaps Earth's greatest achievement is moon rocks. Oh, and the golden age of radio.
Ooh. Truly a species with much to offer.
Seriously? Are we listening to the same guy?
Yes, another unsolicited celebrity endorsement for the Golden Age of Radio. Join me, Max Schmid, for the best of radio's history. Comedies, mysteries, you name it, we'll have it. Programs you may remember, if you're over 80, and programs that you've never heard of before. All fascinating stuff, Sunday nights, 7 to 9, right here on WBAI New York.
On Saturday afternoon, March 31st, come learn tools and techniques for how to maintain weight and boost your health with educator, health coach, and dance instructor Fumileo Chesney. She'll guide you through creating healthy meals on a budget with tasty Brazilian, African, and Caribbean flavors. Reserve a place by purchasing tickets through the website cooktolive.org or by reaching her on Facebook. Keynote speaker, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams will be there. Saturday, March 31, from 3 to 5:30 p.m., Cook to Live, or call 917-971-9247. That's 917-971-9247.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Hi, my name is Trevor. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM, and when I'm back home in Tampa, I listen on the web at WBAI.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Bob Lederer and Catherine Davis. In this week's program, in the first half, we're going to be taking a look at what's going on in Albany around healthcare issues as they come into the closing weeks of the budget negotiations. Lots to talk about there, so stay tuned. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The Capitol Hill newspaper, The Hill, reports that President Donald Trump's new plan to combat opioid addiction nationwide, announced this week, calls for stiffer penalties for drug traffickers, including the death penalty where appropriate under current law. Trump also wants Congress to pass legislation reducing the amount of drugs needed to trigger mandatory minimum sentences for traffickers who knowingly distribute certain illicit opioids. The Trump plan includes a mix of efforts that advocates have been supportive of in the past, such as expanding access to the gold standard of treatment for an opioid addiction and assuring that first responders are equipped with opioid overdose reversal drugs. It also includes law enforcement measures, and addiction advocates have been urging the administration and lawmakers to steer away from a war on drugs approach that they say hasn't worked in the past. The Trump initiative details actions the administration can do on its own, while also calling on Congress to pass certain measures that the administration says could combat the epidemic that's killing more people per year across the country than traffic accidents. The plan includes three main elements: reducing the demand and overprescription of opioids, cutting off the supply of illegal opioids, and increasing treatment and recovery services. The administration aims to cut opioid prescriptions by one-third within 3 years by implementing a safer prescribing plan. This includes incentivizing states to move to a national database monitoring opioid prescriptions to help flag people requesting numerous prescriptions from numerous providers. The president will also urge Congress to change a decades-old rule that greatly restricts Medicaid from funding residential treatment in certain facilities for those with an opioid addiction, a move that could cost billions of dollars, however. President Trump convened an opioid commission last year, which introduced its final recommendations on how to curb the epidemic last fall. In late October, the administration declared the opioid epidemic a national public health emergency, a move it extended another 90 days this past January. Advocates have expressed frustration that it hasn't led to much concrete changes. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are hammering out legislation to combat the opioid epidemic. The House Energy and Commerce Committee plans to bring a package to the House floor by Memorial Day, and a bipartisan group of senators has introduced a follow-up to the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act passed in 2016 at the close of the Obama administration. The Associated Press reports that, according to a new report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, abortions in the U.S. are very safe, but getting one without facing delays and false medical information depends on where women live. The report, released last week, shows abortions are increasingly being performed early in pregnancy when it's safest, and that at that point the risk of maternal death is higher from tonsillectomies, colonoscopies, and actual childbirth. While state restrictions may be intended to reduce overall abortions, the report said these barriers can reduce the quality of care for women who undergo the procedure by preventing them from receiving the type of abortion that best meets their needs in a timely, equitable, and science-based manner. Overall, the abortion rate dropped from 29 per 1,000 women of reproductive age in 1980 to now about 15 in the year 2014. Better contraception, fewer unintended pregnancies, and state restrictions may have played a role, according to the report. 90% of abortions are performed by 12 weeks, and a growing number far earlier than that. Most women seeking abortions are low income. The findings echo previous safety reports and a 2016 Supreme Court ruling that gutted a sweeping Texas anti-abortion law by citing medically unnecessary limits. States have tested the limits of abortion law since it was legalized in 1973, and the methods that to provide it have also evolved. 25 states have five or fewer abortion clinics, and a handful, such as Mississippi, have only one, according to the report. About 17% of women travel more than 50 miles to get an abortion. Medically, the report says that bleeding and cramping are the main expected side effects of abortions, but serious complications, including infection and hospitalization, are actually very rare. In addition, the longer-term abortions do not increase the risk of breast cancer, and abortions have no effect on future mental health issues, including depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder. Nor do they affect future fertility or other pregnancy outcomes, with one exception. Studies do link multiple abortions, two or more, with increased risk that an eventual first birth may be premature. Most abortions can be provided safely in office-based settings, the report concluded. A physician is not required for the two methods of early abortions, including a medical abortion, and they can easily be performed by other trained providers, including nurse practitioners, midwives, and physician's assistants. Other abortion procedures used in the second trimester do require more specialized skills. Additionally, like with any outpatient procedure, increased sedation used with more invasive measures requires appropriate equipment and trained staff, according to the report. The report was funded by six private foundations. And finally, Reuters reports on the unexpected death last week of Democratic U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter. She was a Kentucky blacksmith's daughter who became a leading progressive voice in Congress from upstate western New York. She was 88, suddenly died after an injury sustained in her Washington, D.C. home last week. She was born in Kentucky, but first elected to Congress in 1986. She served as chair of the powerful House Rules Committee for 4 years from 2007 to 2011, the first woman to hold the position, and at the time of her death was the top Democrat on the committee. One of the longest-serving women in the House of Representatives, Ms. Slaughter fought for the rights of women and minorities throughout her tenure. She was a strong supporter of the Affordable Care Act, and as Rules Chair, shepherded through a complex legislative process to get it passed in the House. Before her political career, she studied microbiology and public health and was the only microbiologist currently serving in Congress. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment in a moment, taking a look at healthcare issues that are on the table in this year's state budget negotiations in Albany. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at health issues that are at play in the New York State budget negotiations that are going on in Albany right now. The Assembly and Senate have both responded to the governor's budget proposals, and now we get down to the nitty-gritty. Joining us to help sort all that out is Ben Anderson, Director of Health Policy for the Children's Defense Fund of New York. Welcome back to Health Action, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the particulars, let's talk a little bit about the process of how the budget gets developed. First, the governor puts out his proposals in mid-January. Then what happens?
Well, after the governor submits his proposals, both the Senate and Assembly hold hearings on those proposals, at which time you have stakeholders from across the state and concerned citizens testifying both in person or submitting written testimony, which is all then taken under consideration. And then just a few weeks ago, you had both the Senate and Assembly releasing their own proposals, which brings us to sort of what takes place in the budget dance over the next week or two, which is the representatives from the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor's office all getting together to negotiate and hash out the differences in their various proposals.
And that's all due by the end of this month.
That's correct. You know, New York law requires that the budget for the upcoming fiscal year, which begins on April 1, is, of course, settled by that date. While it may not always happen, it typically does, and that's no exception this year.
Great. So let's now dig into some of the main areas that are on the table. We're both your organization, my organization, are involved in a statewide coalition called Healthcare for All New York, which is one of the major consumer advocacy coalitions in Albany around healthcare issues. And there's an agenda that the coalition has put out, so maybe we can just tick down some of these major ones. The first area concerns kind of various aspects related to enrollment and post-enrollment in the Affordable Care Act, or for that matter, in any health insurance coverage. Let's take those sort of one at a time. The first is funding for a program that helps people get enrolled in health insurance. Help us understand that a bit more.
Sure. New York State provides funding for a program called the State Health Insurance Navigator Program. That program typically operates on a five-year contract, which was initially slated to expire in the middle of 2018. Since there's been a short extension to take the program through April of 2019, folks who participate in that program provide in-person assistance to individuals who may not feel comfortable jumping on a website or picking up the phone to enroll in insurance. Oftentimes, there are individuals that have really complex either health situations or income situations that make it really difficult to sign up for insurance without the assistance of someone who, is really knowledgeable in these areas. And so that's what navigators do. And that program provides around $27 million to organizations across the state to provide these resources, help folks get signed up for insurance, answer their questions along the way. Unfortunately, we haven't seen any increases in funding for that program over the past 5 years. And we know if we're going to maintain the incredible and historic coverage rates that we have here in New York, that we're going to need to step up our funding for the Navigator program, particularly in light of attacks that we're seeing from Washington.
And then it's sort of companion program. It helps people once they get enrolled in whatever coverage they may have, even from their job, if they have problems. Tell us about that.
That's right. So there's a separate program known as the Community Health Advocates Program. And that program, as you touched on, helps New Yorkers sort of understand how to use their coverage once they are enrolled. And this program, is available to all folks regardless of where they're getting their coverage. So if they're getting coverage through an employer, on the exchanges, and so forth, they're, able to pick up the phone and get the advice of a community health advocate. Now, that program, was funded at a much higher level years ago. There were some budget cuts in recent years, and so we're asking the state to sort of come closer to those historic funding levels and provide about $4.5 million to ensure that program can continue. And it's a great program that saved New Yorkers millions of dollars in terms of getting care that they need or reducing hospital bills. I know it's prevented many folks from going into bankruptcy just by helping them walk through how their benefits work, making sure that they're not being denied care or paying out of pocket for things that they shouldn't be.
Okay, another big issue this year is concerns funding that's provided to hospitals for charity care, indigent care, different kinds of terminologies are used. Without sort of getting too technical on this topic, I know can get pretty technical pretty quickly. What's really at stake here?
Well, so the system that New York has for allocating funding to hospitals for what's known as charity care, so care for folks who are either don't have insurance or maybe they're underinsured in ways and can't afford the out-of-pocket expenses associated with their care. New York system does not take into account sort of the full extent to which hospitals are actually serving those types of people who are in need. We essentially have a system of I would say winners and losers, where the money is kind of allocated without being tied to the actual dollar amount of charity care that's provided. So you have a number of hospitals that are being reimbursed more than they should, and you have a number of hospitals being reimbursed way less than they should for this type of care. And so what we're asking the state to do is to make things right and end that system this year.
Great. And another big thing that's in play in Albany this year is sort of a new issue that we've not really had on the table previously is something called a healthcare shortfall fund. This is an idea of the governor's. What is he proposing?
Yeah, so coming into, I think, important context for this, to give a little bit of background, coming into this calendar year, there was a lot of uncertainty around what was happening at the federal level. You know, so just before the governor put out his proposal, or I guess at the time he put out his proposal, we didn't yet know how CHIP was going to be funded, what amount it would be funded for. And CHIP is the Children's Health Insurance Program. And we also, you know, at that time didn't really know what the federal government was going to be doing in terms of spending on community health centers. And knowing also the attacks on Medicaid that had happened the preceding year, the governor thought it wise to put together a fund called the Healthcare Shortfall Fund to help cover any sort of losses that the state might incur as a result of federal cuts. And so that's what this proposal is attempting to do. Of course, since that time, you know, some of those question marks around CHIP funding and the community health center funds have been answered. But you you know, I think some folks are still uneasy and would like to see this fund established in the event it's needed in the future.
Right, because the war on healthcare in Washington is far from over.
That's right. Yeah, we know there will be further attacks in the future.
Yeah, the new tax law in particular has blown a hole in the federal budget, a huge hole, and President Trump's latest budget proposals proposed to fill that hole essentially by going after healthcare and other social programs, cutting them way back. So that fight continues. How is the governor? We are generally in Albany this year in the midst of a deficit, a budget deficit that they've got to fill. So they got that to deal with. Plus, how is he going to pay for these new things like this healthcare shortfall fund?
Yeah, yeah. So like you said, it's been a really tough year in healthcare. We know the future state budgets will likely be stressed from all of these things happening in Washington. And so what the governor's proposal does is a part of the tax cut proposal in Washington, insurance, health insurance companies in particular, saw a reduction in their taxes. And so what the governor said was, look, you know, we know that you're getting sort of this unexpected windfall from these tax cuts, and we know that that there will be future attacks on healthcare, federal healthcare spending. So, doesn't it make sense then to sort of recapture those funds by way of taxing the health insurance companies and setting aside those monies into this healthcare shortfall fund?
Another thing that advocates have been pushing, and this is a way to provide coverage to certain immigrant communities that don't have any options at the moment, is to expand the Children's Health Insurance Program. Since this is right in your wheelhouse, can you tell us a little bit about what the idea is here?
Yeah. You know, it's so, again, you know, we know that there are attacks on the federal healthcare system. There also are a number of attacks on immigrant communities coming out of Washington. And we know that these sorts of attacks are making it more difficult for folks in immigrant communities to get and keep their coverage. So the idea is to ensure that families in New York are able to keep their coverage by expanding the what's called Child Health Plus, which is New York's children's health insurance program, expanding that to individuals up to the age of 29, up to 400% of the federal poverty level, regardless of their immigration status. So if you're, you know, not able to get coverage through your employer because of your immigration status, if you're not able to get other types of coverage because of your immigration status, New York would have its own state-funded portion of the program that would offer coverage to those individuals up to the age of 29. And we already do this when it comes to coverage for children up to the age of 19. So, you know, we've got a lot of children who, you know, once they age out of the program, they no longer have coverage, which is quite a different experience if you think about the experience of kids who, you know, are able to stay on their parents' plans into young adulthood. So this is just an extension of what we're already doing in other areas.
And this would be directed toward coverage. The so-called dreamer population, if you will.
That's right. There are a number of dreamers that fit into this age range. So it's a you know, critical program from the perspective of ensuring that dreamers are still able to get the coverage that they need.
So this is an idea that advocates have been pushing. How are the lawmakers in Albany responding to this idea?
Yeah, so we've been talking about this idea for some time now. The proposal did not make the governor's budget proposal. It was also not taken up in the Assembly or Senate one house, what we call one house bills, their individual proposals. So what I think you'll start to see more of are organizations and concerned citizens getting together to really make this happen. I know there's an organization called Coverage for All New York that's circulating a petition, so folks are interested and want to make their voices heard. We encourage them to sign the petition.
Yeah, and my experience has been in talking to lawmakers about this issue is that in concept, nobody seems to be really opposed. It's more a matter of finding the money for it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's an ask that would require an additional $80 million in the budget. You know, I think there are questions about whether or not it's something that the state can afford. Of course, I think is. We look through the budget. As I look through the budget, I think there is room in this year's budget and later years for this proposal, but it's not been picked up yet by either.
It's particularly challenging in a year where they have already have a budget deficit hole they got to fill. So, trying to propose anything new is a challenge. Another idea that advocates have put forward is to help people out with some of their out-of-pocket costs when they go to use their insurance that they get under the Affordable Care Act. Those folks who are just above qualifying for public programs and therefore go into the new private marketplace. Can you talk a little bit about what the idea is here?
Sure. So essentially what's being proposed is for folks who are at income levels between 200 and 250% of the federal poverty level, that we should sort of set aside some funding to help reduce the deductible for those individuals. It's something that would really help folks be able to use their healthcare benefits, and it would sort of be a continuation of similar policies that we see in other coverage areas.
Great. So now let's zero a little bit in on some issues around children's health care in our last few minutes that we've got left. One of the things that your organization has long focused on is what's called early intervention services. Where are things standing with that now?
Right. So early intervention services, just for folks who don't know, are services that are available to young children before kindergarten starts, and maybe child has been identified to have some sort of developmental delays or something that would make it more difficult for them to sort of start kindergarten on time and ready to learn with their peers. It might be, they might need some occupational therapy to help out with some mobility issues, or they might also have some speech and communication delays and need some speech therapy. So these services are really critical to making sure that kids remain healthy and show up at school ready to learn. A number of years ago, back in 2010 and 2011, the state was in a really tough budget year.
During the peak of the Great Recession, yes.
that's right. And so they enacted some pretty steep cuts to the early intervention services program, cuts that have never been increased since. But this year, we've sort of have a window of opportunity. The governor proposed a 2% increase in rates for providers participating in the program. His proposal also came with some additional requirements around billing and screening and evaluation for services. The assembly, in their proposal, did away with sort of the more administrative requirements around providing these services, but kept the 2% rate increase. We didn't see any movement or change in terms of what the Senate was proposing, but I think it's remarkable, knowing what a tough budget year this is, that there is the possibility of increasing rates for these services. And we've seen a number of providers sort of exit this area. No longer provide early intervention services. There are wait lists in a number of communities. So it's an issue that's really critical, like I said, to make sure that kids across the state are, showing up at school sort of on track, on target with their peers and ready to learn.
Great. Well, we've been talking about healthcare issues that are in play in the budget negotiations in Albany this year. We're heading down to the last 2 weeks of the negotiations between the governor, the Senate, and the Assembly. Helping us give a little background on it, we've been joined by Ben Anderson, who's Director of Health Policy with the Children's Defense Fund of New York. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Ben.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. And we'll be back with Catherine Davis. We'll be back with something special in a moment. Stay tuned.
Transmitting live from the top of the Empire State Building on WBAI, 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio in New York. This is...
this is what will happen if the Empire State Building gets its way. Just because Donald Trump is president doesn't mean that the real estate companies should control our airwaves.
But it's not too late. WBAI is too important because it gives a voice to the people, people like me.
WBAI gives the people of this city a voice that's heard around the state and the country.
You could donate at givetowbai.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org. Or text transmit 995 to 41444. It's not too late to save WBAI. Don't let them silence us.
And welcome back. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine. And my guest this segment is Dr. Jewel Pulchram. And she is Chancellor of the Jewel University of Immortal Sciences and former private physician to Nelson Mandela. For decades, Dr. Pulchram has been aiding and educating individuals to expand and heal their lives in areas of health, purpose, and consciousness. If you have been seeking your purpose, fearful of taking that forward step, these principles will provide you with the keys to unlocking the parts of you that have been dormant and will ensure alignment with universal order. So I just want to say hello and welcome Dr. Jewel Pulchram.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and I'm so glad to be here, Catherine. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. And for those of you who listen to the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, you could go there and look at my archive there for the Saturday show, Heart of Mind Radio, and you'll find a full hour in which Dr. Pulchram and I go into great depth on some of these subjects. But today we are here with you on WBAI because I couldn't let you miss out on this really a great opportunity, but just a way of getting connected to some very powerful wisdom. And Dr. Pulchram will also be in New York City coming Saturday, March 17th, and she will be doing an event from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m. It is a sort of a luncheon at Roosevelt Square Professional Building, and that's in Mount Vernon, New York. And for those of you who want to connect with that, we'll give you a contact number. I believe I have a contact number that was sent to me just a moment ago by Dr. Perlman. You would call 770-383-2112, and we'll get that. We'll connect that back to you at towards the end of the segment. But I always like to give the information out so that people can jot it down and then double check it. Tell us something about yourself. I know that you, when we spoke earlier, you talked about you healed yourself using these universal principles by accessing the universal principles. And of course, you've been doing this work for many, many years, but I think that when you personalized it, it might have even expanded your understanding of how to teach this.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, again, thank you so much for having me, and I want to definitely give thanks to all of the great teachers that I've ever had and my recent teachers and my teachers from the inside and all the teachers that are in the cosmos and in many dimensions, you know, what is really happening now. If all this transition that's going on, our planet is going through a pole shift. You know, it's kind of interesting that people at least are beginning to accept climate change, but no one seems to go beyond to recognize, well, why is the climate changing? And every 6,000 years, we have this chronicalized archaeologically that the planet changes its north and south axis. It's north and south pole. The magnetic poles change every 6,000 years. And so we are definitely in the throes of that activity. And, of course, the climate is going to change when the north and the south poles, which total different locations, 180 degrees different. Yes, everything is going to change. And what does that mean? That means that our polarity is changing. That means that now we have the opportunity to activate more of our own DNA with new information, et cetera. So it's kind of funny, you know, they have the movie series out known as the X-Men. Well, do we not understand who that is? That's us. That is us. And the new potentials are now available to us in our own DNA. So just very quickly, what did I discover when I had the initiation of transforming myself from a disease state to a state of health? It was to discover how great we are. Each and every one of us is an incredible being, a divine being, a living God. And when we accept that about ourselves and go within to develop all that is still unknown to many of us, we will see this for ourselves. So this is why we really love the athletes and we love the exceptional artists and the exceptional singers and dancers, because that is one quality or two qualities that they are expressing as a representation of their divinity. But each and every one of us have unlimited qualities within us, but it requires us to go within to develop them. So my willingness this time to go within and to heal myself was the key that actually opened up this doorway to find out all these limitless capabilities that I have. No one could have ever told me that I would ever be a chancellor of a university. And this university is so special, not only to me, but for all of humanity. Why? Because its 13 colleges teaches the innate information contained in all of ourselves about ourselves. So even though when you visit our website and you can see perhaps that the titles that the colleges are using to describe their content, this is all information that has literally been encoded within every cell of our body. So it's a wonderful thing to recognize that you're going to a university that is teaching you solely about yourself. Now, universal principles, how does that fit into the scheme of things? And what I discovered, I tell you, I have studied so many things. I've gone around the world, all different type techniques, et cetera, all of them marvelous for what they do. However, there's a core, an essence, a source that everything radiates from, radio knowledge, radio light, and just like our sun. So what is that core consciousness that everything is radiating thought from? And that is known as universal consciousness. And that form of thought, that frequency of thought, that radiance of thought is the primary basis for the consciousness of everything. So whether it's a picture or a worm or a cake or a sofa, every fabric, every fiber, every cell that is responsible for building these objects that we have named the consciousness in every fiber, every cell, et cetera, is that of universal principle. So I discovered after this entire dissertation through this labyrinth that we've created known as life, that if we could realign ourselves with the very consciousness of every cell in our body, we would never have to worry about illness again. We would never have to worry about disease. And definitely no such thing as death. And we know that already. I mean, I wanted to know why those cells of Henrietta Lacks are able to stay viable and zealously ready to multiply and to take on any template that they're put on to make a ear, to make a bladder, to make a uterus, etc. And they live in just simple protein, carbohydrates, fat, and room temperature. And they, the owner who of those cells, her body has decayed, et cetera, over 60, 65 years ago. But those cells are still alive. And why? Because they now are literally vibrating in their own consciousness, which is that of universal principle, which is forever, perpetual, always in balance and alignment with self and the environment. And so therefore, when their environment changes, they immediately align themselves and take on the milieu of the environment. Voila, you got an ear. We put it on, you know, an ear template. Put the cells on the ear template, voila, they've made faces for individuals who've had severe trauma to the face, et cetera. And so why did all the cells that still remained in the consciousness of Miss Lax expire and return back to the void, while these cells are still able to maintain their geometry, their viability, and are still able to do what? Follow directions, because a template is a directive. And that is because they had no other influence in thought other than the original thought that they were built from. That's universal principle.
Wow,
so
that's...
It's been a wonderful gift to know that after all this I've been through as a surgeon, as a researcher, I mean, oh my gosh, to get down to the very core of what can allow us to finally be and to finally learn who we are very simply with just the practice. First of all, the familiarity, the remembrance, the commitment to practice it, and voila, there you are, immortal, healthy, joyous, abundant. It's amazing. It's like magic to me.
Well, I think it would be, it feels like it, but there's actually science behind it. And, as you describe it, there are principles of consciousness connected to it. So it's amazing to me. And, I just wanted to verify, I believe I gave out the wrong date for your event. It's Saturday, March 24th, which is Saturday coming. From 11 a.m. till 3 p.m., and it's the VIP Universal Principal Experience with Dr. Jewel Pookrum. And you can call for information. It's 770-383-2112. And there is an Eventbrite page that you can go to as well, and I'll give that out at the end of our little segment here. But Dr. Pookrum, I would love for you to give an introduction, a brief introduction to the concepts that are illustrated on your website. And for those people who want to connect with this teaching, you could go to juis.education, and you could even register there and become a VIP member of the site. But you have the Dr. Jewel's Balancing Program, the Law of Time, and the Hollow Mind Perceiver. And I know that everything is interconnected, but can you give a brief explanation of what these three principles are?
Well, they are literally sciences. Okay, so they are sciences, and the balancing program, the brain balancing program, is the use of geometry to restructure and to realign the neuronal connections of the brain. And so this program is quite dynamic in that we know that we use geometry to realign, to recreate everything. So whether it's the reorganization of a room, the straightening of a limb, okay, the repair of a face, we are always dealing with that primal template geometry. And geometry can and does realign the neurons of the brain. And so one of the things that I discovered, and we have accepted that about ourselves, that we only use somewhere between 5 to 10% of our brain. And of course, I know that I have colleagues who say, oh, no, we use all of our brain. Now, let's be clear about the word use. Of course, all the blood circulating through all areas of the brain, if the brain is physiologically healthy. But in consciousness, are you consciously able to sit in the prefrontal cortex of your brain and actually use that area of the brain with its software programs and capabilities? And the answer is no. This is why we have individuals who are left-handed or right-handed. There's very few people who are ambidextrous, but we were created to be ambidextrous because you have to think about it. It doesn't make sense that if I want something on the left side of the desk that I have to cross over with my right hand to reach it, usually, because we've become so unilaterally brain-oriented. And it's really been a problem in throughout our society. So why does that happen? Well, when we have an environment that does not support the growth of the brain at the rate of the cellular aspect of the body, of course, the body's going to continue on its growth curve, but the nervous system does not. And how do we create that? Well, when we are raised in an environment, or should I say the environment is saturated with values and belief systems and behavior that support fear, anxiety, the perception of lack or inadequacy, the chemistry made by your own brain suppresses neurologic advancement and integration. And we call that stress. We call that anxiety. And we know that the primary chemical, adrenaline, does not support brain growth and development. It actually brings it into almost cessation. So when we're young and we have these experiences and we're told by our environment that it's dangerous, we're told by our environment we see death, we're told by our environment we're feeling an uncomfortable environment, no heat, improper clothing, food, etc., the nervous system does not grow at the same rate the body does. And so therefore, we know that most people, especially in the Western world, do not have complete access to the brain and consciousness. So when I talk about brain development, we're talking about restructuring the brain literally. We know the brain is very plastic. We call that neuroplasticity. We're exposing it to the geometry that will allow those neurons to reconfigure their connections, reconfigure their position in a circuit in the brain. Consciousness then, by just a little provocation, can flow into those new areas. And everyone that completes the program, it's so simple, it's only 15 minutes a day, they recognize, well, you know, I feel much more comfortable, I feel much more confident, you know, I recognize that, you know, I had the same experience, and I'm looking at it differently, I'm handling that experience differently. You know, mm-hmm. I expected this. Yeah, because you have more brain tissue to see the choices.
Well, that's pretty amazing that we could actually develop our brain tissue. I would also like for you to spend a few minutes on the hollow mind perceiver.
Well, now that is about an area of our existence anatomically as well that we're very unfamiliar with. We use the term a lot, mind, but most of us really don't understand it. It is an etheric, anatomical aspect of ourselves. And again, most of us only see ourselves through our physical perception. So the emotional body, the mental body, or the mind, most people really can't perceive of. And now with more information on the brain, we're feeling more comfortable with the brain. Well, how do they really fit together? Because most people just kind of flip it and all they do is talk about the mind. But then there's very little discussion on the brain, but we know that without a brain, the mind really means nothing. So the mind literally is what we call a multidimensional, fifth-dimensional and above construct, physical construct of the human anatomy. And this is where literally the fields of information in the form of light and beyond, because matter can exist also beyond that of the electromagnetic spectrum, where we have access to all kinds of ideas and all kinds of thought patterns. But with the use of the brain, they actually flow through from multiple spheres, The mind is actually multiple spheres. Right now, we're able to identify six. We have identified in the brain that the brain itself and the cranium can accommodate a brain that is able to interact in consciousness up to 11 dimensions. And so right now we're working through the fourth and the fifth dimension, and we have a brain that can do that, but most people have not been developed to that extent. So the mind is definitely processed by the brain. So if we have six mental spheres, for example, and we only are able to activate in consciousness three circuits of the brain, then that means there are spheres, information of thought, et cetera, that a person cannot be aware of, cognize, because of the limitation of the development of the brain. So that's why we recognize that if we are able to allow the brain to become whole, literally where the right and the left hemisphere become one, there's a truncate of what we call axons. It's like a major cable. Once the cable standardizes itself, just like the fiber optic cable, once it's standardized where we know the wavelengths of light are going to be able to be transmitted through each fiber, the same thing happens in the brain. That's what we're really creating. A fiber optic system is really the corpus callosum of the brain. Once that's stabilized, then we know that there's a certain standard of information that the brain is going to be able to process from its mind, its mental spheres. So the HMP, the whole of mind perceiver, literally is the teaching of not only the mental spheres of an individual mind, but also how all of these thoughts, radio thoughts coming from all the cosmos, etc., are able to be processed through one's mind. Now, it would have been so great if Mr. Hawkins, Stephen Hawkins, would have been able to give a discourse on literally how he's able to send his mind out into space to Orion, to a Pleiades, and all these other star systems and beyond, to talk to us about black holes and to talk to us about supernovas, etc.
Well,
because his plane was able, it was developed to that extent that he could use his mental spheres, his mind, to access the bigger mind of the cosmos, which is the holo mind perceiver, to get this information and to bring it back to us.
Beautiful.
So the university introduces the primary instruction and exercises for individuals to be able to completely integrate the right and left hemisphere of the brain and to then begin to integrate and learn the mental spheres, the contents of the thoughts that they contain, and then how that relates to the cosmic mind or the holo mind perceiver.
Wow. Okay. You know, it's unfortunate we're getting so close to running out of time for this program, so I wanted to make sure people can connect with you, because you are going to be right here in New York on the 24th. It's this coming Saturday, so you know you want to connect right away to make sure you have a place in this event. And there is an Eventbrite link. I'll read it to you all, so get your pen ready. It's http://bit.ly/2os4xne. So that's a lot, but you could always call, and the number to call is 770-383-2112.
Correct.
And the event is on Saturday the 24th from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m. at the Roosevelt Square Professional Building. And the address is 11 West Prospect Avenue on the third floor in Mount Vernon, New York, 10550. 11 West Prospect Avenue on the third floor in Mount Vernon, New York, 10550. And again, the number to call to get info to register is 770 1-800-383-2112. And remember that you can also go to Dr. Pookrum's website, juis.education, and you can register there to receive updates from her. And for those of you who have missed this information, you could always send an email to myself, and I'll be happy to send you an email with all the details.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
And my email is heartofmindradio@gmail.com. A lot of you know that, heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And unfortunately, we're just plumb out of time, Dr. Pookrum, and I look forward to being able to bring you back to the show. Bye-bye for now.
Well, thank you, and I hope to see you soon. I will. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone. See you soon, New York. Love you. Thank you.
Here are some words that matter to all of us at WBAI. Listener supported, commercial free, resistance radio. Hi, my name is Catherine. I'm host of Heart of Mind, which you can hear on Mondays at 1 p.m. Please take a minute to consider what your radio landscape would look like without this station. At WBAI, we consider you a part of our vital community, a vital cog in our radio wheel. At WBAI, we keep it grassroots. We're powered by your generosity, not corporate interests. Remember to donate by visiting...
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI. Listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What do you want me to do, a bunch of them?
Good morning.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a pre-recorded edition to stay out of the snow, but we have fine interviews from Heliosphere, a science fiction convention last week, and we'll be talking with Charles E. Gannon and Eric Flint. Stay tuned. Good morning. So, as mentioned, this is a pre-recorded edition of the show out of Hour of the Wolf Studios, you know, that giant building in the middle of Manhattan or Brooklyn or somewhere. And, well, you know, the snow and all that. So don't look for Facebook Live. I ain't doing one out of the house or anything like that. But we have recordings of two really cool interviews from a con held last week. But first, we must promote the next reading. And that is April 3rd at the Brooklyn Commons, same building as WBAI, 388 Atlantic Avenue, on April 3rd, as I said, at 7 p.m. You won't want to miss this one. Chandler Klang Smith is a graduate of the MFA program at Columbia University. Her new novel, The Sky Is Yours, was listed by Entertainment Weekly as a best new book. And it got a lot of good reviews in many places, including Tor.com and LitHub and NPR. And she is simply a delight, and be sure to come by. And our other reader on April 3rd. Chris Claremont writes both comics and prose. His initial unbroken 17-year run on Marvel Comics' The Uncanny X-Men is uncanny. It is the stuff of industry legend. The story arc Dark Phoenix, with its radical treatment of the story's central character, paved the way for the reinterpretation of superhero mythos throughout the comics industry. His work is lauded for its anti-prejudice themes and groundbreaking inclusion of minorities as heroes. His stories are the source material for Marvel's string of X-Men movie and TV projects, including Legion and next year's major releases Dark Phoenix and The New Mutants. He has published 9 novels with more on the way. Chris's papers are archived in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library of Columbia University and are available for research. So again, April 3rd, 7 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Very easy place to get to. Admission is free, but we will look at you dolefully for a donation of some kind to the reading series. And we hope to see you then. Weekend before last, I was at Heliosphere, which is a new science fiction convention held right outside New York City in Tarrytown, Westchester. And this was its second year, and they had 2 fine guests of honor. And they are Eric Flint and Charles E. Gannon. We will hear the two interviews I did with the two guests of honor as part of the convention. First up will be Eric Flint. Eric Flint is an American author, editor, and e-publisher. The majority of his main works are alternate history science fiction, but he also writes humorous fantasy adventures. He became the first librarian of the Bain Free Library, that's Bain as in Bain Books, and a prominent anti-copy protection activist. He has edited the works of several classic SF writers, repackaging their short stories into collections and fix-up novels. This project has met commercial success and has returned several out-of-print authors to print. Later, Flint became editor of the new Jim Bain's Universe science fiction e-zine, while concurrently remaining a creative writer bringing out 3 to 5 titles per year. He lives with his wife Lucille, also an ex-labor organizer, in East Chicago, Indiana. So set your way back machine to, a week ago last Saturday, and listen to an interview with Eric Flint. This is my second time. First, I'm Jim Freund. I do a radio show in New York called Hour of the Wolf, dedicated to science fiction and fantasy, and delight, honored, and thrilled always to meet people like Eric Flint. And this is our second time doing a guest of honor interview with him in Westchester.
Yeah.
So, pardon me if I ask some very basic questions as opposed to the deep dive interviews on, you know, the niceties of 1632 or whatever, and we'll do the more like, gee, what is 16, not yet, what is 1632? But also the thing about interviewing Eric Flint is that he is one of, particularly to me, one of the most fascinating people with one of the most fascinating backgrounds in genre literature or any literature. I just admire your shall we say, CV, or simply what you've done with your life from even from early days.
Okay.
So much. Would you like to talk? Because otherwise I can't.
Well, for anybody who does not know the basic, and probably most people in the world, put it mildly, don't know the basics of my biography, I went to UCLA. I was born and raised mostly in Los Angeles, California. And I screwed off in high school, so I wound up going to junior college afterwards. Then I transferred to UCLA, which is where I got both my bachelor's degree and master's degree in history. But in the course of being a student, I actually started in the civil rights movement and became active in the anti-war movement. This is during the Vietnam era. I graduated from UCLA in 1968. And I became a socialist, and I got first involved in it when the Teamsters Union went out on a wildcat strike in 1970 that was centered in Cleveland and Los Angeles. And it happened to coincide with the mass student strikes over the Cambodian incursion. And the Teamsters came on UCLA campus. I wish I had a copy of this bright red leaflet they passed out, which was basically power to the workers, power to the students. It was this ultra-radical leaflet they passed out. And the reason they did it was because it's a wildcat strike. For those of you who are not familiar with the terminology, a wildcat strike is a strike that is not sanctioned by the official union leadership, which this wasn't, because the official union leadership had signed a contract and the rank and file was mad because they thought the contract was lousy. What happens with most strikes, but it particularly happens with wildcat strikes, is judges will immediately slap down injunctions and prevent the workers from having more than a token number of pickets. And the reason the teachers came on to UCLA was because they wanted to have students do mass picketing for them, because that circumvented the judge's ruling, because a judge cannot prevent a citizen from exercising their right to free speech. And so we, myself and friends of mine, organized an organization called the Student Worker Action Committee, and we were mobilizing several hundred students a day at the Teamster, at the barns where they were picketing. We were doing almost all the picketing because they couldn't legally. But in any event, it all became a moot point because I left UCLA, never to return, and became a longshoreman initially. I had been working as a longshoreman part-time because one of my fellow graduate students, his father was in a longshore union, and when he explained to me that I could go down